That's how I make it.
We have a seat, please.
We have Culberson versus Conwell. Good afternoon, gentlemen. And have both of you signed in?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Okay. Come on up. Got a 50-50 chance of being the right one. Thank you, Mr. Murphy. Mr. Goff, would you like to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Please, the court, 4 minutes, please.
Yes, sir.
May it please the court, my name is Josh Goff. I'm honored to be here today on behalf of Mike Culberson. The issues in this case are whether there was probable cause to search Mr. Culberson's vehicle and whether the child court imposed an impermissible sentence.
Mr. Goff, try to get to the heart of assignment of error one. As I understand it, your client had given testimony and said to the officer at the scene, it wasn't his car, he wasn't the driver, he had nothing to do with the car except that whoever was supposed to come pick him up had left the keys in the car, left it unlocked, so he reached in, took the keys out of the car, and was going to walk down the street to try to find the operator of the car, whoever it belongs to.
That was certainly the testimony at the hearing, Your Honor, and the trial court rejected that testimony.
But by giving that testimony, did he not testify his way right out of having any standing?
No, sir, he did not, because the case law on standing, as quoted by the Commonwealth's attorney, says standing is determined by a totality of the circumstances. And so, in looking at the testimony that was adduced at the hearing, we have an officer, Officer Moffitt, who testified in no uncertain terms. She did a U-turn, pulled around, saw a vehicle occupied only by Mr. Culberson, saw Mr. Culberson leave the vehicle, and then Mr. Culberson was pursued by another officer, Officer Robertson, where the keys to that vehicle were found in his pocket.
But I guess the part I'm having problem with is how can his privacy rights rise any higher than his own testimony? How can he have it both ways? My defense to this is I didn't have anything to do with what's in the car. But if somebody finds to the contrary, you shouldn't have been able to search it. How can he assert a privacy right to something he denies any connection with?
Because it is only one factor to consider, Your Honor. So his testimony about a possessory or ownership interest is certainly a factor for the court to consider. That factor was far outweighed by the other testimony that was adduced at this hearing. And no reasonable trier of fact.
Tell us what those other factors were.
Having a possessory interest in the vehicle, having a reasonable...
He denied that, didn't he?
But the other evidence clearly established that he did have a possessory interest. The officer saw it herself.
But to assert standing, doesn't he have to assert a possessory interest?
I researched that question for probably hours, and I can't find any case law that says that the defendant has to assert it. The case law says it's a totality of the circumstances. And this is a rare case. I agree. Usually, if a defendant denies any ownership or possessory interest, that would normally be the end of the matter. But the evidence was so clear here that Mr. Culberson was the only occupant of that vehicle, even with Mr. Culberson testifying that he did not drive the vehicle. The other evidence, in viewing the totality of the circumstances, established that he was the only occupant of that vehicle.
So for us to hold that there was standing, we have to say that the appellant was lying to the police.
I would prefer to phrase it that the appellant was wrong.
And well, he knew, I mean, we can use whatever words we want, but he knew the circumstances. And in an effort to try to distance himself from the facts of the case, he said, not my car, didn't drive it, have nothing to do with it. So we would have to reject that in order to say that he had standing.
Yes, sir. I'm asking the court to reject that testimony. It clearly was rejected in the trial court. It should be rejected by this court because in looking at the totality of the circumstances, the appellant had a possessory interest in that vehicle. He had a right to exclude other people from that vehicle, and he had a right or a reasonable expectation of privacy inside that vehicle.
Contrary to his statement.
Contrary to his statements.
Was standing raised below?
No, sir, it was not.
So how do you get to ends of justice?
In looking at page 9 of the appendix, which is trial counsel's written motion to suppress, my argument to the court is that paragraph 2 of page 9 of the appendix says that any evidence and statements that were allegedly obtained stem from the unlawful arrest in violation of the 4th, 5th, and 6th Amendments. Clearly, we're dealing with a 4th Amendment issue here, and the glass smoking device that was recovered several sequences down from the arrest of Mr. Culberson. So the trial court could find that the officer had a reasonable suspicion to stop Mr. Culberson. There is a different standard on whether to stop Mr. Culberson than to whether to search the vehicle. But ultimately, they had to use the keys discovered in his pocket to open the door to the vehicle to recover the smoking device. So it all did stem from the arrest of Mr. Culberson.
Well, let me ask you a question about that. He was placed under arrest as a result of them seeing the glass smoking bowl.
Yes, sir.
And your contention is that that is not probable cause sufficient to place him under arrest.
Well, I would prefer to phrase it, the Court of Appeals and Supreme Court have made that contention that where you have something that can be used for a lawful purpose.
But that's not what you argued at the suppression hearing.
Well, the trial counsel took a different...
I'm sorry, what trial counsel?
The trial counsel took a different approach to it, but the overall argument as to whether there was probable cause to enter the vehicle, I would submit, was preserved in the trial court.
Not with respect to that particular item that was found constituting probable cause. Would you agree with me on that?
I would agree that wasn't mentioned, but it was mentioned in the testimony. However, in the trial court, the standard is not whether things could have been more artfully raised. The standard is whether the trial court was presented with sufficient facts to make a ruling, an intelligent ruling on the issue. And here,
you don't think that defense counsel had an obligation to say to the trial court, hey, wait, that pipe is not evidence sufficient because of these Supreme Court and Court of Appeals case?
It was a different strategic decision, I think, but still the trial court heard the evidence about that and had the opportunity to make a ruling as to Mr. Culberson's Fourth Amendment rights and whether they were violated or not. But as to just briefly as to the ultimate issue, assuming that Mr. Culberson does have standing and the issue was preserved, the line of cases cited in my brief do establish that just seeing something that is commonly used for an illicit purpose, it does not itself establish probable cause. And here, the standard is probable cause to enter the vehicle, regardless of whether it was reasonable suspicion to stop Mr. Culberson. And a glass smoking device is a legally sold device, and that is the only description in the record. And I don't believe the court even received a picture of the glass smoking device. So the only description we have to go on is that we have a glass smoking device which is sold in a variety of stores and are sold ostensibly to use tobacco. Clearly, frequently, they are not used to smoke tobacco, but it is no different than the line of cases that suggest a hand-rolled cigarette or a film canister or money folded a certain way cannot itself establish probable cause. So I would submit, in looking at the totality of the circumstances, the case does not turn on whether a criminal defendant, takes ownership of some piece of property. There's no case that says that. All the cases say that you must use a totality of the circumstances approach. And in this case, the evidence is so overwhelming, the evidence that the trial court was presented with to establish that no one but Mr. Culberson had a possessory interest in that vehicle and thus did have a reasonable expectation of privacy.
So let me look at this a little bit differently. The officer said that the appellant car was parked against or facing traffic, and she testified you're supposed to park with traffic, not against traffic, and it's a violation of the city code to park left on the curb. Wasn't that her testimony?
That was her testimony, but then the testimony was also when one of the officers was asked whether they did an inventory search. The testimony was no, because the car was legally parked. That was also her testimony.
Well, let's say, there's case law that says that if the officer objectively believes that there's a violation, then they can cite him for that traffic violation, although some officer disagrees, right?
If there's reasonable suspicion, certainly.
Well, the car was facing the oncoming traffic. And so then he then leaves the car, rapidly walks down the street. Why can't the officer then arrest him for that traffic infraction?
Well, just as criminal defendants can't have it both ways, the Commonwealth can't either. So the Commonwealth can't say no inventory search was done because the car was legally parked and then have an officer say that it was parked the wrong way from traffic. That may be a violation of the Hampton City Code or it may not. There's no evidence as to that. The trial court didn't make a ruling on that. What we do have is clear testimony that they did not rely on the inventory exception to the warrant requirement because the car was legally parked. And if there are no further questions, I'll reserve the remainder of my time.
Afternoon, Mr. Murphy.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. It's Payne Murphy for the Commonwealth.
Mr. Murphy, can you help me with something at the outset? Because I feel like we were almost talking in circles a little bit earlier. Is it the Commonwealth's position that the defendant has to establish that he has standing to confess the search?
It does, Your Honor, if we get to that point. The main problem in this case is that if you look at the trial record, and as the defendant cited, page 9 of the appendix, which addresses why this motion to suppress isn't being brought, the challenge was to the stop of the defendant, in a field beyond where the other officer was watching him. After that officer had been told that the other officer had seen suspicion of drug of narcotics and radioed to him and asked him to detain the defendant. That was the action that was challenged in the trial court. And if you look, you see throughout that the challenge is that there was not sufficient evidence to stop him or sufficient probable cause to arrest him, because he was arrested for his resistance to the detention. There was never any issue in the trial court as to whether the seizure of the smoking device was improper, an improper use of the plain view doctrine. That is a new issue presented on brief in this case that was not presented to the trial court. As a result, there was never any discussion of standing because we never got that file. There was no challenge to the officers going into the vehicle, so that didn't arise. It would now arise if you, in fact, would look at the other issue, that is the plain view seizure. And, of course, if that had been the issue, then the Commonwealth would have had available to it the response that you have not established standing. And if you look at Atkins, which we've cited, it makes clear that the defendant, if the defendant fails to make any kind of claim of possessory interest, fails to assert any standing, any reason to have control over the vehicle or any connection with the vehicle, he has waived any claim of a Fourth Amendment violation. He says, because you have to come in court and say I have these rights and you have violated these rights. I don't know anything about this car. I've never seen the device. I've never driven the car. You then can't say, well, yeah, but you can't go into that car and take that device because of...
Because you don't believe me and find that I do have some connection with it, all of a sudden I can contest the search.
Absolutely, Your Honor. But I think the main problem is that if you look at what we have here, is a challenge to the stop exclusively, and says that anything that followed thereafter was tainted by the initial impropriety of the stop. There's no, and nowhere, the only place he cites is, I think, page 69 of the appendix, where he says that the, page 67, where the word plain view was used, but it was only used in explaining why what the officers saw, 67 going up to 68, established probable cause for the stop. Never any claim that under the plain view doctrine the Commonwealth could seize the smoking device without any further under that theory. The claim was simply I was improperly stopped, and even if you saw the device, you didn't connect me with the car in any way. As you remember, that was one of the arguments, that you hadn't really connected him with the car. He said it wasn't his car. Therefore, why are you stopping me because of this device in that vehicle?
Mr. Murphy, correct me if I'm wrong. The assignment of error assigns error to probable cause to enter the vehicle.
Yes, Your Honor, it certainly does.
All right. And below, the argument was no probable cause to stop.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is the issue preserved?
No, it is not. Not preserved in the simply because you raise it in your petition. It is not. It's clearly a 5A:18 issue. And in order to get to it, you have to determine that the trial court, in fact, addressed that issue, and it did not. Now, the fact that we didn't, or the common attorney didn't address that issue and say, well, that's not before the court, that's not binding on us when we next pick up the case. We can assert anything that upholds the judgment at this point. And we are bringing to the court's attention that although the Commonwealth attorney didn't raise it, in fact, there is a real waiver. There's a total waiver of the initial point, the probable cause for the stop, because that wasn't briefed. There's a waiver under 5A:18 with respect to the seizure of the smoking device because it was not argued below.
And can we address standing when standing wasn't raised below?
You can address it if you decide to address this issue of the...
if we get to the merits of assignment one.
Right. If you say, okay, we're going to look and see whether there was, if the seizure of the smoking device was proper. If you're going to get that far, if you're not going to assume that that is waived because it wasn't raised below,
right,
then yes, certainly we should be able to raise standing.
Since it wasn't raised below, don't we have to do it on a right for wrong reason analysis?
Well, right. I mean, well, you don't have to do anything because I think you have a complete waiver here of both issues. I mean, they didn't brief the probable cause for the stop. That's waived. The other claim was not raised below. The trial court was never asked, please suppress the smoking device because it was seized without probable cause under the plain view doctrine. They said, suppress the smoking device because I was stopped improperly, and that stop, any fruits of that stop are inadmissible. And that's the closest anybody ever got to addressing the smoking device. So I think what we have is a double waiver, both of the initial claim and of the new claim. And so standing is not really significant unless you get to that, improperly get that issue. If you do, then I think the standing issue is determinative of that. The defendant insists, and his lawyer insists, that he's not connected to the vehicle. How can he then possibly argue that's a Fourth Amendment violation? With respect to the merits, if you do get the plain view, I mean, it's an interesting area. I've said lots of cases from other jurisdictions where they have, in fact, said that viewing a glass pipe like this is sufficient for seizure. Now, the difference between Grandison, Brown, and... forget the third case. This case might sound like Governor Perry. But the three cases cited by the defendant all involve a film canister, a rolled-up dollar bill, a $20 bill, and rolled cigarettes. Well, those all have innocent uses. There are no innocent uses demonstrated for this. The defendant, on brief, doesn't even argue anything. And, of course, there was nothing discussed about that in the trial court because it wasn't an issue, because they never got to that issue. But, in fact, there's no reason to believe that there are any alternative uses for a glass smoking device apparently used for crack that would, in fact, that would support the reliance upon those other cases. Those cases... The film canister obviously used all kinds of reasons. Same thing with, obviously, money has all kinds of uses. And I'd say the same thing with the hand-rolled. People do roll their own cigarettes, illegal cigarettes. But to talk about the legal uses of smoking devices, there isn't any discussion of that, and there's no evidence that supported that there are possible alternatives.
Was it a pipe or just the stem?
It's hard to say. The judge saw it. Made that clear that it was displayed to the judge, and he was able to view it and decide what it was. But I don't know exactly what it was.
It was not a classic tobacco pipe.
Oh, no, no. It was a glass. It was clearly not an ordinary pipe. And I think that's why the various cases that I've cited from other jurisdictions said, well, this is plain view. That's used only for narcotics. It's not used for, there is no legitimate common purpose for this instrument. So, as I say, a lot of courts in other jurisdictions have said, yes, once you see that, it's in plain view, it's contraband, you can seize it without any further steps.
Would you like to address the sentencing issue?
Oh, yes, of course. We are going to have to give up on part of that because it's clear that the judge could not impose an additional 4 years. The claim about the improper supervision, I think, is waived. And I cited the case where this same issue arose and it was waived. And there's no can be no real challenge to the imposition of additional time, since that's in fact required by the statute that requires the kind of post-release supervision.
And this wasn't post-release supervision. The judge did not impose post-release supervision. The judge just sort of on her own said, "I'm going to give you some suspended time."
Right.
Suspended.
Yeah, but I mean that treatment was authorized under that. The supervision statute. You could, in fact, increase it. In fact, you required, whatever the judge called it, he was required to impose some time on the fence under the statute you cited.
Let me see if I've got. So, what you are saying is that the judge was wrong to impose any suspended?
No. But he was wrong. The statute says you can impose up to 3 years additional suspended time. He imposed 4 years additional suspended time. And that was too much.
But he also added on to the other time, didn't he? There was no distinction in this order between the post-supervision time and the other time.
Yes, right. He, in fact, reduced the active time to be served. So, I mean, he reduced the amount of active time that Mr. Culberson would be serving. So that he reduced the time, but he made the sentence longer. The felony sentence, he increased it. He added four years of suspended time, and the most he could add was 3 years.
Okay. Well, you're talking about 1925.2, which talks about post-release supervision. And you're saying that there is a provision in that statute which allows for suspended time as well as post-release supervision?
No, well, it allows you to add 3 years to the time the jury has given.
3 years suspended time and not just 3 years post-release?
No, it has to be suspended time. You can suspend up to 3 years, but you can't suspend any more than that.
And you can do that after a jury verdict?
Yes, Your Honor. Yeah, that's the purpose of it, to make sure there is some time of supervision for somebody who's committed a felony. In this case, the judge added too much time onto the sentence. It was 4 years instead of three, so it really has to go back for the judge to redo the sentence. And unless there are any further questions, I request that you send it back to sentencing and otherwise affirm the conviction.
Thank you, Mr. Murphy.
Thank you.
Mr. Goff?
Regarding the sentencing issue, I agree that the case should be remanded back. But it should be remanded back with no instructions. It should be an entirely new sentencing. It would be just as if the trial court had imposed 15 years active on a possession of Schedule 1 or Schedule 2 charge. We wouldn't remand it back and say only give him 10 years. We'd say that's an impermissible sentence, which, contrary to what the Commonwealth said, can be raised at any time, at any stage of the proceedings. This was an impermissible imposition of time. The trial court gave Mr. Culberson more time than the jury imposed.
Well, the Attorney General agrees with you.
But it wouldn't need to go back to a new jury for sentencing, would it? It just needs to go back to the trial court to correct that error.
I would concur with that, yeah.
Okay.
And I think the statute says that.
And regarding the standing issue, just one response. I did actually reference illicit use for a glass smoking pipe, and the Attorney General the Commonwealth seems to be presuming a lot of things about the glass smoking pipe. All we have in the record is that it is a glass smoking pipe. That's it. And it's called a pipe which is generally used to smoke tobacco, and there are a variety of glass smoking devices that are legally sold in businesses that have business licenses issued by the city and lawfully operate their businesses. We have nothing else in the record other than it was a glass smoking device.
Well, was it submitted in evidence?
The device itself was submitted in evidence, and then it apparently was given back to the officer, according to the record. What we have in the record is that we have a glass smoking device. That's the only description.
And the trial court's finding that it was used for illicit purposes.
Well,
consistent with the...
Certainly it was used for...
The jury's...
Apparently, certainly it was used for an illicit purpose. That's not the standard on the motion to suppress, though. It's whether just looking at it with a flashlight and a locked car through the window late at night could establish probable cause by itself. That's the assignment of error Mr. Culberson raises at this stage of the proceedings. And to distinguish the Atkins case slightly, again, I concur with the Commonwealth that 99 times out of 100, if a defendant disclaims any ownership or possessory interest, that would be the end of the issue regarding standing. This is the one out of 100 time because we have such clear evidence that Mr. Culberson was the only person operating that vehicle. He was the only person at that time who had a right to exclude someone from that vehicle. He was the only person with a key to the vehicle in his pocket. He was the only person who locked the vehicle prior to leaving it. And in looking at the totality of the circumstances, he has standing to challenge an illegal search of that vehicle.
But how does he, I guess the question I've got is, if he files the motion to suppress, he's representing that he has standing to do so. But then if he comes in and testifies that he has no interest in that car whatsoever, how does he then assert a privacy right to it?
That is but a factor for the court to consider. And that is what
but,
the case
but I guess my question is, to keep from this becoming a chicken of the egg argument, how does he rise any higher than his own testimony when it comes to asserting his own privacy or constitutional right?
Because he was not the only one who testified at the hearing, and the trial court has to weigh everyone's testimony. And in fact, the case law would say that Mr. Culberson's testimony, he was impeached by prior crimes of moral turpitude. He was impeached in various other ways.
So he gets the benefit of being deemed to be incredible?
He's certainly receiving no benefit because I'm getting
the
line of
questioning. But do you understand how absolutely nonsensical that is?
I strongly disagree that it's nonsensical because it fits squarely within the case law, and I would suggest this is the one out of 100 time where someone can disclaim a possessory interest and still, under the totality of the circumstances as viewed by the trial court, be able to establish a possessory interest. Because there is no case law, Atkins included, which involved a passenger in a vehicle with a driver, that says that you must assert a ownership or possessory interest before you have standing. It's always listed as a factor.
But I guess the key is he's got to assert it. He's got to establish it. And if he can't establish it by his own testimony, he can't then call witnesses to then contradict his own testimony. He can't do that. He can't have witnesses try to make him rise any higher. So it would then be the Commonwealth's evidence. But if this were presented to a court, he can't get by his own testimony to get further withstanding. So it gets eliminated after he's testified. You don't get to the other witnesses.
It is no different than in a trial, Your Honor, if the Commonwealth calls a hostile or reluctant victim who testifies unfavorably to the Commonwealth and the defendant.
Except that it didn't happen here, so you can't presuppose what other witnesses.
No, but bottom line is, he's saying, I need to impeach my own testimony to have standing.
The Commonwealth impeached his testimony with their own witnesses in the trial court.
But they don't get to their witnesses if he's the one that asserts he's got standing. He testifies, tries to establish it, except that he's not trying to establish it, and then it goes away because you don't get to the Commonwealth's witnesses.
I understand.
Because it happens before trial, not during.
I understand that's the court's position. My position is there's no case law that supports that. It is but a factor. It is not dispositive.
Mr. Goff, let me ask you, let me go back for one second to the sentencing issue. Do you agree with the Commonwealth that 1295.2 gives the court the authority not just to impose 3 years plus release supervision, but to impose 3 year suspended sentence?
Well, the statute appears to say that up to 3 years, anywhere from 6 months to 3 years, is suspended upon doing post-release I would just, I know my time's up, but emphasize that the trial court imposed probation, which is different than post-release supervision.
That was something that I noted as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll come down to Greek Council before.